Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. I would like to continue in this third talk of the Rains Retreat of 2002 to give some skillful means, some help to developing peace in one's monastic life, happiness in one's daily activities, and also harmony between one's fellow monastics, and in a way which will lead to a deepening of one's meditation experience, and also a liberating from the prison of delusion into the freedom of enlightenment. And the particular aspect of the practice I wanted to talk about this evening, again, because of a couple of people during interviews talked to me about this, I was on the at least two of the four Brahma Viharas, the divine abidings, and in particular the ones which I practice of metta and upekkha. I don't do too much of karuna and mudita as a formal practice, so I think I'll probably focus on the metta and upekkha. And again, one of the reasons for talking like this today is that last week I gave the talk on the body awareness, which included some of the asupa reflections. And those super reflections, they do need to be balanced by the reflections based on metta, on goodwill, in order to be able to have both aspects of the practice. First of all, asupa, to untie the mind from its infatuations, but also loving kindness in order to attract and keep the mind on the vehicles which take it to the deep states of meditation. When we're talking about loving kindness, I'm going to focus more on the way we can use loving kindness with our meditation objects. But first of all, that some people have asked, actually, how do you practice loving kindness in the meditation as a meditation by itself? And always the way to do that is to use thought, but use thought directed onto a particular object. So usually that when we think, it can be very diverse and go off onto all sorts of branches. But with the preliminary stage of loving kindness meditation, you should keep the thoughts constrained in a certain area of experience called loving kindness, to channel it along the path of loving kindness. What those words actually are, which you think to yourself, you say to yourself in the silence of your mind, can be taken out of a book or out of the suttas, but usually that I would encourage people to choose the words for themselves, to be inventive, and to choose an internal monologue which resonates, you know, with one's conditioning, which means something to you, and which can generate the feelings of loving kindness. And I'm not going to spend too much time on this, because you've probably heard me talk about how I practice loving kindness. I usually have to start with an object which is very simple, something which is very easy to generate feelings of loving kindness upon. And for me, that's usually a small kitten, simply because I like cats. But for each one of you, you can choose an object, whichever object is easy to develop feelings of warmth, kindness, care towards. Use that as an imaginary object, a visualization in your mind, and to direct the thoughts of loving kindness towards, around that object. The reason for using an imaginary object at the start of loving kindness is because you have more freedom to construct something which easily takes loving kindness. If you use a real person, a real thing, then that real person, that real thing has its defects, has its faults, has its past history, and sometimes it's hard for the mind to develop loving kindness on such an object. An imaginary object has the all of the freedom to construct something to be easy to develop loving kindness upon. So you can use your imagination to construct something. And many people I've taught this to have again been inventive in the way they've used that imaginary object. And one person in particular I recall in Sydney many years ago could not do loving kindness on a person, nor on an animal, because they weren't all that fond of pets. But they could actually construct loving kindness around a small plant they had just received as a gift, which they were growing in their apartment in Sydney. And they could visualize this small sapling. And to use that vision in their mind of a small plant needing attention, needing care, needing nurturing, and developing tremendous feelings of loving kindness around that imaginary object. And so I only mention that to show that we can use almost any object as the seed for our loving kindness. I call it a seed because it's like lighting a fire with a piece of paper. You have to choose something which is easy to light a fire with, like newspaper, which is dry, and it takes the fire. You can put on the twigs and the logs or the coal, the charcoal afterwards, but you don't put the difficult things on first of all. Once you have the easy object, when you are directing thoughts to generate loving kindness, please always remember that the thoughts are there as a signpost pointing to what loving kindness means. So when you say to your imaginary object, you know, may you be happy and well, may you be free of suffering, always pause between the statements. Not between the words themselves, but between the sentences, if you like, between the phrases. Because as you pause between those phrases, that those sentences will have the effect of pointing the mind onto the meaning of those words, onto what loving kindness truly is. All those words, that internal monologue, is all to point you in the direction of what loving kindness feels like as a physical or emotional experience. So as you say the words that, you know, may my little kitten be happy and well, you pause and you listen to experience what happens next in the mind after those words are finished. All words have power to elicit an emotional or physical response in the mind or the body. And if you listen for that result, you can actually start to see the fire of loving kindness being kindled inside the body or the mind. It only kindles a little bit. That's why you have to say something again and again and again and again. Many, many times you continue this thinking inside the mind, this monologue. But it is a directed speech on one thing, and it is not continually talking to yourself inside. There is a sentence, and then there's a space, the pause, where you're listening to the result. And only when the result fades away, then you put another sentence in, another phrase, and you listen again, then another phrase, then you listen again. It's a very methodical and careful way of using thinking. So it's not thinking gone wild. It's thinking which is controlled, directed for a certain purpose, for developing loving kindness. And when the loving kindness, the metta, really starts to grow, then you need the words less and less. Any word of, you know, may that being be happy and well, it creates such an echo of loving-kindness, such a reality in one's body and mind of what loving-kindness truly is. You can just pause in silence, and what occupies your mind, what's in your consciousness, is what I call the meaning of loving-kindness. You know, the metta before the words. You know, what the words are pointing to. You know, the goal of all of this. And once one starts to get the goal of loving-kindness in one's mind, what loving-kindness feels like in the emotional world or the body world, that is, in all cases, an extremely pleasant experience. And it's because of the pleasure of that experience, the piti sukha of loving-kindness, that you need the words less and less. The loving-kindness is strong, and it grabs the attention. And only when the mind starts to get a little bit restless and starts to move away from loving-kindness, only then do you need the words again, you know, may all beings be happy and well, to push the mind again back into where it's supposed to be focusing. In this way, you can develop loving-kindness sort of more and more. If you wish, you can change the objects, you know, to another being, a real being this time, or all the beings in this monastery, or all the beings in the whole world, in the whole cosmos. But be careful, the whole point of these words, whether it's one imaginary being or one real being or many beings or the whole cosmos of beings, the whole purpose of loving-kindness at this stage is to be develop the meaning of loving-kindness, the piti sukha, which is one of the most powerful aspects of loving-kindness. Some aspect of that loving-kindness which you can focus on and keep your attention on for a long period of time. And if you can generate that feeling in the body or the mind of loving-kindness, eventually the bodily feeling will be so much, but the mental feeling of piti sukha will be far greater. And you can just focus on that without needing any words at all, simply because it is so enticing, alluring, engrossing, that it grabs the attention so firmly, simply because it's so beautiful and wonderful. You don't need to say anything. In fact, you can't say anything. And so it generates that stage in meditation called silence, and that important stage of meditation called the arousing of piti sukha. And that piti sukha is aroused just on that feeling of loving kindness, on the loving kindness which is pointed to by the words, but now you're actually experiencing that thing as a reality in the mind and also a little bit in the body. And again, as you focus on that more and more, the bodily part of loving kindness, whether it's a feeling around the chest or wherever else it's focused on, will disappear. And you'll be left with the mental part of piti, of loving-kindness, which is, again, far more refined than what can be felt in the body. You're going again to the realm of the mind and leaving the body aside, using the piti sukha of metta as your vehicle for liberation. And if one can do this and just focus on just the sheer bliss of this loving-kindness, going more and more into it, more centering into it, which is relatively easy because, again, of the piti sukha, is the glue, is the attraction pulling you in and in and in, then, of course, that's how one can gain the liberations of mind through metta. The liberations of mind are equivalent to jhana states. They're equivalent to jhana states because you have this beautiful piti sukha, the happiness, which it becomes effortless because you don't need to try and control it, to hold it, to keep it, because it keeps your attention. The attention just doesn't need to do anything. It's like it kidnaps your will and holds you in this beautiful state of loving kindness. And of course you can stay there for a long time without any effort. There's no speech, there's no chetana within that state. And you become inaccessible to the five sensory realm. You're just having too good a time inside, focusing on loving-kindness. And so it becomes a way of developing the liberations of the mind, the vimokas, the jhanas. And of course, once one comes out afterwards, you know, from those loving-kindness states, you come out and you still take with you, as well as the piti sukha, just the inclinations by which you entered that state. The mind will very easily be inclining towards loving-kindness, and any words which get formulated in the mind are very likely to be words of loving-kindness. And that's a marvelous time to start spreading loving-kindness towards all beings, all the beings in this monastery, all the animals, all the insects, all sentient beings, including yourself. Because the state after deep meditations is extremely powerful. And then you can really spread loving-kindness. As I've mentioned before in other contexts, the mind after samadhi has enormous power. And if you understand through experience the power of the mind after samadhi compared to its weakness before, you realize that if your intention is to spread loving-kindness towards other beings, it's far more efficient. You get far more results by entering into a jhana first and then spreading loving-kindness rather than trying to do it before. So in this way, you can develop the liberations of the mind through loving-kindness. For those of you who have been trying to get the jhanas through the breath and you've found difficulty doing that, then try a bit of loving-kindness meditation. It's not all that hard to develop. And because the happiness comes quicker, relatively speaking, than doing the breath meditation, some of you might find that a very powerful and efficient vehicle to gaining samadhi. And please also remember that this mind, which we are working with, that we should be very kind and gentle with it. If we're working against the mind, which very often is the macho attitude of some, you know, Western meditators to try and conquer the mind, you know, with force, you often find that that mind will rebel. And that rebellious mind you'll experience as not being able to get the mind on the breath, not being able to get any stillness, getting more and more frustrated, more and more tight, and also more and more disappointed. And sometimes you wonder, why is it that when I'm on retreat, when we've got all this time to myself, why is it I just can't really get this mind together? And a lot of people make the mistake, they get frustrated, so they try even harder. And the mind sort of resists even more forcefully. Because they're not working with the mind, they're working against it. It's important, whether you're doing metta meditation or breath meditation, to have gentleness in one's approach. That's why that I've often used a simile in Nolamara of the mind being like a small baby. It's your little child. And if you want that mind to settle down, you have to treat that mind the same way you'll treat a baby when you're trying to get the baby to settle down at night and go to sleep to give you some peace. If you go up to that baby and throttle it, grab it by the neck, stare at it, and shout at it, "You settle down and go to sleep or else, baby!" All you end up doing is winding up that baby. It starts screaming and shouting, and eventually you get done for child abuse. And I was thinking, I told some people that if there was a crime of mind abuse, many of you will be in jail right now, the way you've abused your poor old mind. So be careful not to abuse this mind with such aggression. If you want a baby to go to sleep, you very gently stroke it and talk very softly to it. "A nice baby, go to sleep." Sing it a little lullaby. You can do that to your mind. Sing it a little lullaby. You know, that form is on fire, so the eye is on fire. Sing it the lullaby of the Adita Sutta, the fire sermons we just chanted. Or sing it the lullaby of the Dhammacakka or the Anattalakkhana Sutta. But do it very gently. And then just stroke it just with mindfulness and with piti sukha. And when the mind is comfortable, then it will become very malleable and do what you tell it to. It will just, the body will disappear and just left with the pure mind. you do need that gentleness. And in order to develop that gentleness, loving kindness is terrific. It's one of the greatest assets to a monk to be able to develop. And it assists the loving kindness. So it assists the breath meditation or the super meditation or whatever other meditation you're doing. So it is quite all right, and it's to be encouraged in this monastery, especially when you're doing lots of meditation, to change the meditation around from time to time, not always doing the same old thing. If you try and do the same old thing hour after hour after hour, the mind will not delight in the sameness, it will get bored, it will get frustrated. So try a little bit of loving kindness. In the way I've taught meditation before, you see that, this is straight from the suttas, that loving kindness is the antidote to ill will. And that ill will is very powerful hindrance in Western people. Very often we have very deep-seated ill will towards ourselves, towards our body, or towards a meditation object. Ill will towards the body, you know, means when you're tired, right, I'm going to sit up tonight. This is the real practice. Go to hell, body. It doesn't matter about what you feel like. I'm just going to sit through all of this. When you're not caring about your body, then your body gets sick. And it's not malleable. It gets tight and painful. So you have to be very careful that you're not a person who has ill will towards a body. Obviously, there's the alternative of that, the opposite of that, you're just indulging the body all the time. But there is also that part which is ill will towards our body. And there is also that part which is ill will towards ourself. And this comes about by the feeling in our meditation when things start to get peaceful that I don't deserve this, I can't do this. All those types of thoughts, I can't do, I don't deserve, this is not for me, these are all a bit of ill will towards oneself. Being overly critical in a negative sense towards one's abilities, towards what one can do or one can't do. That's part of ill will. So loving kindness towards oneself is a way of overcoming that. So you allow yourself to be happy. You give yourself the benefit of the doubt. You're kind enough to allow yourself to bliss out. And you deserve to bliss out. This is the fruit of this monastic life. You've given up so many other ways to be happy by coming to this monastery for this rains retreat. Some of you monks have given up all those things for 10, 15 years. So surely you deserve some happiness. And it's very reassuring to read in the suttas, the Buddha said, I allow you monks the happiness of the mind, what he called niramisa sukha, the unworldly happiness, such as the happiness of jhanas, the happiness of piti sukha, which comes before jhanas, the happiness of inspiration, the happiness of the the joy based on living a simple, beautiful, virtuous life. All of those happiness, the Buddha says, go for them, enjoy them. You deserve every one of those happinesses. But sometimes we don't allow ourselves to be happy, again, because of ill will. So a little bit of loving kindness can overcome that. But there's also the loving kindness which abolishes the ill will towards your meditation object. And this is very common, unfortunately, with monks who watch the breath. If you've been watching the breath and you haven't had good results, just check that out. Have you got ill will towards your breath? When you start watching the breath, what sort of attitude do you have towards it? Is it an enemy which you have to control? something which you are trying to govern and master? Because the master or the mistress, like some slave master or mistress, they can be just so cruel to their servants. And of course the servants will never work very well for you that way. So be careful, you're not a tyrant over your breath. That shows ill will towards your breath. You don't start watching the breath saying, right breath, and I'm going to watch you, you better not go anywhere. Instead, you can use loving kindness towards your meditation object. And when I was talking to someone in the interview periods, I recall to myself, when I started using loving-kindness on the breath, when I combined these two great meditation objects and put them into one, and it was extremely powerful in their quick results which they produced in my meditation. Because it was such a powerful result that I remember the time when I did this. It was on a Friday evening at a retreat, a weekend retreat in Safety Bay. And all of you know how hard I was working in those days during the week. And after working all day and getting all my stuff together and just rushing out to Safety Bay, just had a whole weekend retreat to start teaching, and I was pretty much tired out. And so just to get myself in order so I could produce some decent talks, just the first sit, you know, before the first talk at the Safety Bay retreat, I think I was sitting there while the organizers were still giving the last pieces of advice, you know, the housekeeping for the weekend to the retreatants, and I'd already gone to sit in the hall, and I carried on sitting until the first talk. I gave a very lovely talk, because what I was doing before, the talk was loving kindness on the breath. So instead of just trying to watch the breath with coldness and with harshness, I started to anthropomorphize the breath and to look upon the breath as like a child. It's something which I was holding in my arms with love and with care. And it came to me on that evening, the simile, that if you are holding a baby which you love and care for, no matter where you are walking, even if it's over rough terrain, you will never drop that baby. And if you go to the shops or to the mall, you will never leave that baby on the counter or on a bench somewhere and afterwards wonder, heck, where did I leave that thing? But this is what you do with the breath. You drop the breath somewhere. And you know, afterwards you start watching the breath, and then you think about something else, somewhere else. Where did the breath go? And also you don't know where you left it. That's because you don't care for it. So by having that simile of looking upon my breath like a child, like a baby, anthropomorphizing it, making it into a being. And we can do that in our Western culture. You know, we give names to our cars, we give names to our houses, to our boats, we give names to even anything. You can't have a cat as a pet without giving it a name. And even if you've got a kangaroo you feed every day, you've probably already given it a name. It's just what we do, is in our Western culture. So you can actually give this breath like a sense of being, even give it a name. And once you've given it a name, giving it a sense of being, then you find you can have that like care and kindness towards it. And you're combining these two great meditation objects in one. You're watching the breath, but with loving kindness towards it. Breath, may you be happy and well. Breath, may you be free from affliction. Breath, may you be at ease and be at peace. You can see what would happen to that breath. Instead of trying to control it, you're liberating it, but with care. And when you don't control these things relax and become very peaceful. In the same way that when you give that little baby in your arms a sense of confidence, that baby can even go to sleep in your arms, even though that, you know, you're walking through a busy shopping mall. And the baby is fast asleep, it doesn't care, or doesn't ever imagine for an instant that you'll drop it anywhere, because it's confident, it's in good hands. In the same way that you can almost stop all effort and the breath just stays there, it doesn't move, it doesn't fall out. Because you have this beautiful kindness towards the breath. So first of all, by having loving kindness on the breath, you're actually releasing the breath from this terrible controller, basically from fear. And as you release it from the controller and you just abide with the breath as a great friend, as like a dear companion who you have lots of care towards, then of course that breath will become very smooth and very light. In the same way that if you care for the cat, when you're stroking it, the cat begins to settle down and purr. In the same way that if you're watching the breath with loving kindness, the breath, as it were, starts to purr with piti sukha. It starts to become a beautiful breath. And the reason why it's starting to become a beautiful breath is because the nature of loving kindness is to generate the piti sukha associated with loving kindness. And that piti sukha of loving kindness is put right there with the breath. So you're watching loving kindness and this beautiful loving piti sukha, the happiness and joy starts to arise with the breath. And it becomes just so easy just to watch the breath without effort, and piti sukha is arising because of the loving kindness, you're caring about the whole thing, and you start to get very powerfully blissed out and get into deep meditations. So that was a great experience for me that night, and I always recall that experience because that was the first night after I went to bed and slept at night that I dreamt I was in jhana during the sleep. That's not saying about Uttri-manusa-dhamma, because I don't think that's the sleep state. Just had the nimitta of the jhanas in the sleep states, which was a very wonderful experience. And that sort of was what really pointed out the power of loving kindness on the breath. And of course, in the morning, you woke up, you had a very beautiful meditation first thing in the morning. So it actually can work to put loving kindness directly on the breath, to combine the two, just to make the breath more attractive and to get the right attitude of mind onto the breath. It's a shame that sometimes that we do lots of breath meditation in this monastery, because that's the one which I really encourage, but sometimes it doesn't gel. That some monks think, okay, I've tried it long enough, I can't do breath meditation, but please go back to these instructions and try again, this time with loving kindness, or do loving kindness before, just pure loving kindness, and then go on to the breath. Get that happy mind going, that joyful mind. And when the mind is happy and joyful, you're relaxed, you're having a good time, and it's just so easy to do these meditations. And it's not because, you know, that you're something special, that you've got special attributes or whatever. It's just because the nature of the human being, if it does the right things, does the right instructions, it follows the right path, and this is what happens. It's process. It's got nothing to do with your abilities or lack of abilities. The idea of abilities and lack of abilities is just too close to self-view. So just follow the instructions and see what happens. Develop like loving kindness and softness, and then do the breath, or do the two together and see what happens. And it becomes so easy to do, because you're taking away the hindrances. It's not your lack of paramitas which stops you entering into samadhi, it's one of the five hindrances, that's all. So check out the hindrances rather than worrying about, you know, whether you've got what it takes. So that's actually how I practice the loving kindness with my meditation. And also, if you develop loving kindness in your meditation, you can really spread loving kindness after your meditation, you know, to all beings. And then by giving that energy out to others, you actually, which is a real energy, once you actually experience very strong loving kindness, you experience how powerful it can be, and you can actually help other people with their meditations or with their life. You can give them a boost of energy. So it's a time when you can actually serve others. That's a beautiful thing to do. And again, the more you serve others, the more you give out, the more good karma you make, the more energy you have for your samadhi afterwards. You're boosting your energies and the purity of your mind. So when nimittas do come up, they're even more strong, more beautiful, more pure. And loving kindness is a powerful thing to do. The other of the Brahma Viharas, which I like to speak about this evening, is also equanimity. And the reason I'm bringing this one up again is because when people do lots of samadhi practice, the Buddha said that one should always give attention to two other things. One is pagaha, which is basically, you know, the application to arouse energy. That's how I always understand that word. And the third one is upeka, of equanimity. And these are very important words. the developing energy, loving kindness develops a lot of energy, or reflections upon the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha, reflections upon your good qualities, your sila, your good karma, all the things you've done in the past. What inspires you with piti sukha, you know, with this beautiful faith-like inspiration, joyful states of mind, that this also generates energy inside of you. Sometimes when you're meditating a lot in your rooms, you can get quite tired. You're always bashing away at the breath, especially if you're not getting too many results. So that's the time to say, okay, let's stop. I haven't got enough energy. I'm getting a bit worn out. Mentally, physically, you may be strong, but the mind hasn't got that energy. And so you develop energy-producing meditations. Not doing meditations for the sake of samadhi, for the sake of jhanas, but simply for the sake of energizing, refreshing your mind. And again, that can be reflections on the Buddha, Dhamma, the Sangha, which you can do through doing some chanting if you wish, or reading suttas, or reflections on something which inspires you, uplifts you. And the reason we call it inspiring or uplifting, because it gives you energy. When you've got low energy, you sink to the ground. When you've got high energy, everything sort of starts to rise. That's why it's called uplifting. So it's a way of generating energy. Sometimes the meditation on death can be uplifting, in the sense that it really starts to get your energies roused. When you realize you haven't got much time left, those of you who are very sick, today, you know, maybe, who knows how much time you got left. So it can sometimes, okay, it can be quite fearful, but it could also arouse energy, especially when you got well. When you get well, always remember what sickness is like so you don't waste your time. Those of you who are generally healthy, just go and talk to someone who's sick and just look how they have to, they haven't got much opportunity to do the sort of practice which you can do. So those reflections are ways of arousing energy, which is necessary from time to time when we're doing long periods of sustained practice. And of course this third thing we should do, which the Buddha said, when we're doing lots of samadhi, always remember to do things which arouse energy, but also to develop upekkha, which is a letting go and equanimity. It's interesting that the word pekkha means to look, and I think that's a Sanskrit word, because you always add an S in it, seems to be with pekkha, speka, specs, spectacle, to look. And I was mentioning this at tea time in Ajahn Brahm's etymology of the reason why expectations always lead away from the goal, because expectations, now the spect part of expectations, is like looking, like a spectator or spectacles. And ex means like outside. You know, like you exile somebody. And so it really means expectations, means to look outside. Look outside of the moment. Look outside of where you are. It's the mind going out again. So expectations is, you know, thinking about what's going to happen outside of this moment in the future sometime. It's always looking outwards. And that looking outwards is not what upekkha is, and it's not what leads to peace, to joy, to wisdom, to liberation. The opposite of expectations, in my etymology, is inspectations. In other words, inspecting, looking inside. By looking inside, I don't just mean looking inside the body. I mean looking inside the moment. And so there's a lot of just upekkha there. Not wanting to go anywhere else. Not looking for something else. Not trying to get something else. But looking in on where you are now. Inspecting. Not inspecting in the sense of trying to find out some sort of evidence or trying to use thoughts, but just looking silently in on the moment. That's very powerful, because a lot of the problems in meditation is that we're not happy where we are, we're not satisfied, we want something more because of expectations, therefore we don't pay enough mindfulness to where we are now, our mindfulness goes on to our expectations. So we're not mindful in the moment, we're not mindful of our meditation object, our mindfulness goes off to our expectations. What we want next, what should be happening. It's a form of ill will towards the present moment. I'm not happy here, I don't like this, get out of here, I want something more. I want something else. And that is such a tendency of the human mind, especially the Westerner, always thinking happiness lies somewhere in the next moment, in the next monastery, in the next country, in the next day, in the next year, in the next lifetime. And when I find the perfect monastery, when I get on my retreat, when I get on the perfect retreat, this one didn't work because I was sick, but next time will be the right one. And when it's always like looking for the future. And this is something which I've always doubted for a long time now, which I don't follow. If I want to get into deep meditation, I get into deep meditation now. In this moment, in this sick body, in this heat, in this cold, I don't wait till later on. Now. Even in this rotten old breath, which I find hard to watch, this is good enough. So upeka, just looking in without judging, without wanting anything more, inspecting rather than expecting, and just looking. And as we do this, we're actually letting go of that sort of craving which sends us out looking for, wanting for something else. We're letting go of the asavas, the outgoings of the mind. The mind which is going out from the moment, trying to find its happiness, its jhana, its liberation in the next moment or somewhere else, in the future, sometime, wherever, anywhere but now, anywhere but here in this sick old body, anywhere in this rotten old breath, which is just unpleasant. The reason it's unpleasant is because you don't like it. But sometimes, you know, in my life as a monk, you know, you've lived with monks who are very hard to actually be at peace with. But that's your challenge. If you accept those monks as they are without trying to change them, then you're at peace with them in the same way. If you accept the breath as it is, it doesn't matter how unpleasant it is or how difficult it is, just be kind to it. Accept it as it is. That's part of loving kindness, to allow it to be, to embrace it. Then you find that you can stay with the breath. Again, look at the breath like an enemy, or look at the breath like a friend. To be a friend, it doesn't mean to be a good person. You can be a friend with all sorts of people, if you have the wisdom. And if you're a friend with the imperfect, rotten old breath, then you become at peace with the breath, and you understand how to watch the breath and enter samadhi. A lot of times we've got the fault-finding mind again, the judging mind, and that's actually at a subverbal level when sometimes we watch the breath. We're breathing in and breathing out. This isn't fun. You're actually criticizing and judging the breath rather than just looking upon it with equanimity. Just letting the breath be however it wants. I don't know about you, but sometimes when I start watching the breath is all over the place. It's not at all smooth. It looks like it will never become beautiful. I know how to fix that up. I just don't try and make the breath beautiful. I just watch it as it is. It doesn't matter breath if you like this for the rest of the hour's meditation or 2 hours. You know, just really uncomfortable. Doesn't matter, that's fine. And then almost immediately it starts to become peaceful and beautiful. It just settles down by itself. The upeka is a very powerful way of letting go of the controller again. You're just looking on. You're inspecting. You're just looking in. And that looking into things, you know, is the way to get samadhi. The way to get release. That upeka, the other simile which I gave some years ago, which I still think is one of the, I'm very pleased with that simile, it's one of the best similes of the thousand petal lotus. The whole process of meditation is just opening up the lotus that is your mind and body, your five khandhas. Opening them up to see what's inside, what's in the very center of all this. And that thousand petal lotus got all these layers on it. Petal after petal after petal after petal. And you want to get inside of all this. Not only the deeper you get, the closer you get to wisdom, but the deeper you get, the more beautiful the petals are. And this is what happens in the mind when you're doing jhana meditation. It's not just samatha, it's vipassana as well. The insight and the calm, they always go together. You can't separate them. As you go deeper into that lotus, closer and closer to wisdom, the petals get just so amazingly beautiful. So refined and delicate, and so full of tremendous beauty and happiness. But the way to get into those inner petals is actually to keep your attention on the level of petals where you're on now. Because your attention, your mindfulness is like the sun warming the outside of the petals. The petal on the outside, whatever layer it is, has to receive the warmth of the sun before it will open up. It has to receive the warmth of the sun for a long time, sustained. And then it opens up all by itself to reveal the petal, the level of petals, the layer of petals inside. In that simile, the heat of the sun is a mindfulness, your attention, which has to be sustained on wherever you are now. Whatever you're experiencing now, sustain it on just that. Don't move on to the lotus next to you. You don't move on to something else to get into samadhi. You don't give up what you're experiencing now to try and get something further. That's expectation, not inspectation. So you just go in. Whatever you're experiencing now, this rotten old body, this rotten old breath, just keep your attention on that, mindfulness on that. Sustain it on that with upekkha. Just watching. Just like the warmth of the sun just heats up the dirty petal on the outside. Then that opens up to reveal what's inside of that, which is a far more peaceful, beautiful petal. You don't need to have expectations of what to do next. Where should I go next? Just keep your attention just on this. And then that opens up to reveal the next layer of petals. And that's the way you get into samadhi. And you start off with this body and you go inside onto the breath, onto the present moment, inside time. And then you just focus on that and you get inside the silence. The silence is the next layer of petals, which is just inside the present moment. You go into the silence, the next layer of petals is the breath. It's just right inside the silence. You become aware of this breath. You're just watching this breath. You're not trying to get the beautiful breaths or nimittas or piti sukha coming up. You're just, with equanimity, just watching the breath. And that just opens up to a beautiful breath. It just opens up all by itself. Right in the center of this horrible breath is a beautiful breath. You don't need to give it away to sort of go anywhere else. Just be right here. Go deeper in rather than on to something else. And as you go into the beautiful breath, you have all the happiness in the world. The piti sukha, the nimittas lie right in the center. Right in the center of the piti sukha, the nimittas. You don't need to throw that nimitta away and just to go somewhere else. You don't need to go on to the next thing. You go into this nimitta. Just to develop the stillness, which just allows the mind to rest there with upekkha. Just watching on. Just letting it be. Just observing. With no expectations, only inspectations. And as you do this, inside of that little nimitta is the first jhana. This is what happens. You feel yourself sinking in there, or the nimitta comes and absorbs you. You just go to the center of it. And there you're in the first jhana. And if you want to know how to get the first jhana or the second jhana, you just go deeper into the first jhana. Just like the person just watching this amazingly wonderful layer of petals. of the first jhana. And how do you open up those petals? You don't do it by force, you just wait with upeka. Not expecting anything, not trying anything, just maintain that warmth, that mindfulness on first jhana without moving, and it just opens up in its own time when it's ready into a second jhana. It's the same way from the second into the third, and the third into the fourth. This is just the way that you go deeper into the moment. Just the escape, I just was talking with one of the monks at tea time, the escape of from the sensory world, the hole which escapes from the sambada, the crowdedness, almost like the affliction of the sensory world is first jhana, and the escape from the first jhana is into the second jhana. It's like a hole right in the first jhana, it leads to the second jhana. It's within, it's not without. You don't abandon the first jhana and then go out into upachara and then go into the second jhana. From first jhana, you go deeper into the first jhana to attain second jhana. Deeper into the second jhana to get to the third. Deeper in. You're opening up the petals one by one. And eventually you go to cessation. And that is when you open up the very last petal. The beautiful petal of neither perception nor non-perception. And right in the center there is the old jewel in the heart of the lotus. And you all know what that one is because you heard me talk about that before. If you don't know, then just get into the state of cessation. And this is actually how you open up the lotus. It's all through upeka, just looking on, or rather looking in. So those types of liberations can be extremely powerful. And it's all, again, through letting go, letting be. It actually shows you that where the mindfulness or the energy should go. It's always the energy should go in that type of mindfulness, which also carries along with it the wisdom, into sati and sampajanya. Sati is just the bare awareness, ability to know clearly what's happening in this moment. And the sampajanya is the element of wisdom and understanding. Remembering the instructions, I always call it. So you understand that you have the mindfulness, and those instructions are very simple. Don't do anything. Don't move on to the next thing. To stop the cravings, the asavas, the outflowings of going on to something else, which is our tendency in the mind. Always looking for happiness somewhere else other than right here. Always looking for liberation, for the gold, for the trophy, anywhere but right here, deep in this moment, right in the center. So our job as meditators, as people who are looking for Nibbana, is not to look for Nibbana anywhere else, other than right here in this body and mind, in this present moment called now. Not next week, not after the rains retreat is finished, right now. Not with words, but in the words, in the silence. Don't allow the thoughts to go on to the next thought. Just go into the middle of this thought. Right in its center, where there's no more thoughts or words left. Go right into this breath. Don't wait for the beautiful breath to come in the next moment. It's this breath. In the middle of this breath is the beautiful breath. In the middle of this beautiful breath is the nimitta. Don't throw away the beautiful breath to go on to the nimitta which is coming afterwards. Keep the beautiful breath and just go into its center. Nimitta comes, don't look for jhana anywhere else except the very center of that nimitta. Just keep going in. Inspect, look inside, not go on to something else. So that's like a path with no expectations. I'm not looking for anything outside this body or mind. Not looking for the truth, in the teacher, in the suttas, in the next monastery, in the next religion, or anywhere else. But right here, there's all the treasures right inside of you. That's why I say that people have got the paramitas, because in each one of you there is that beautiful truth to be found in the center of this body and mind, which you're experiencing in this moment. Deeper you go into the center, don't go in the wrong direction. Out onto something else, something new, something different, something fresh. Go in like the simile of the thousand petal lotus. Stay where you are. With upekkha, look deeper and deeper into the moment, and you'll find all these petals open up. When you get past the first few petals, then I won't need to teach anymore. You'll just be able to know for yourself that this is a way to jhanas, to wisdom, to liberation, to freedom from suffering. A1.
Sāvaka-saṅgho